You are listening to the cycling podcast at the 2023 Tour de France. Today, we're in Belleville en Beaujolais.
A victory for a French rider in the Basque country and now a Basque rider in France. In San Sebastian, did you have the bottle of champagne from the bus to celebrate? What will you have tonight, champagne or Beaujolais?
I don't know. It's something that they have. The French, they have to decide. But normally in the team we use champagne. But we'll see what the boss says. But anyway, we're going to celebrate it.
That was Bingen Fernandez, one of the sports directors of the Cofidis team, after stage 12 of the Tour de France, where after 15 years of hurt for Cofidis, they now have two stage wins in this Tour de France after Victor Lafay in San Sebastian, the French rider in the Basque country I referred to, and today Jon Izagirre, the Basque rider in, well, wine country. We are in Beaujolais. My name's Lionel Burney. I'm with Ian Boswell. And as we're in one of the most famous wine regions in France, we're naturally sipping on a nice cold beer, aren't we, Ian? But that's perhaps because we were in the gruppetto a bit today, weren't we? Off the back after a late night seeing off our friend Mitch Docker. A very pleasant evening with some friends of the podcast, which we'll talk a little bit about later on. But Ian, where are we now?
We are in Belleville in Beaujolais. Is that the name of it? I've been making fun of Mitch's French for the last couple of days.
Now it's up to me to actually,
actually make sure I pronounce it right. Yeah, but Mitch, DNS this morning, didn't make it to our stage. And once you miss one stage, you're out of the race.
It was always planned. It was always planned. He was going to do the first 11 stages of the tour, and then he's off to do some other things. We'll miss him, of course, but we're going to recap stage 12, and it's that time of day.
It's time for the tale of the attack.
As we predicted in last night's episode, Ian, a very aggressive stage. The profile lent itself to attacking. Absolutely no respite at all day. They set out from Roanne. They finished here in Belleville en Beaujolais, 168 kilometres. So it was going to be fast. It was going to be hard. There were a couple of second category climbs towards the end of the stage and three third category climbs before that. And once again, with all of the aggression at the start, the GC favourites were making all of the splits at the front. Jonas Vingegaard, Tadej Pogacar, Simon Yates. Real tough racing from the start. And it took a while for a break to go clear. And a big break did go clear. I suppose the story of the day is just that last 50 kilometres. Absolutely hell for leather racing. Kicked off, really, by Mathieu van der Poel and André Amador. Van der Poel, of course, of Alpecin De Koninck, who already have four stage wins thanks to Jasper Philipsen. André Amador, who was in a sort of soft, tippy-tappy break yesterday that was never going to go anywhere. I wonder what he was doing in that, if he had designs on a stage like today, but perhaps we'll discuss that. And, well, it looked like Little and Large riding over the hills and round the corners. Van der Poel left Amador standing still almost on the second category climb of the Col de la Croix Montmain. And at this point in the race, with Thibaut Pinot in that breakaway, AG2R were riding very hard on the front of the yellow jersey group. We'll have to get to the bottom of what they were doing. On the descent of the Croix Montmain, Matteo Jorgensen of Movistar and Thibaut Pinot of Groupama FDJ went clear in pursuit of Van der Poel. And on the final climb, the Col de la Croix Rosier, they caught up. So that gave three riders at the front. Julian Alaphilippe had been dropped from the break, went back to the yellow jersey group and kind of looked across at the AG2R riders on the front, didn't he? And gave them a bit of a look and said a couple of things. I wonder if he was asking, what on earth are you doing, guys?
I mean, I think he was. We were all a little bit puzzled. I mean, there was a couple of times throughout the day when we were puzzled about what a number of riders were doing, which eventually kind of made sense what was happening. But still, to, you know, where we're sitting now, I have no idea what AG2R was doing on the front of the peloton.
I think we may have to wait till episode 6 of next year's Netflix series to find out, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, towards the top of that final climb, Jon Izagirre, the Cofidis rider, one of two Cofidis riders in that break, went away. At that point, Mathieu van der Poel, who had already been caught, was dropped. And so Izagirre won over the top solo and won his first Tour de France stage since winning at Morzine for Movistar in 2016. So his second Tour stage win in all. And after a 5-year drought for the Spanish, two Tour de France stage wins in a matter of days. Second place, Matthew Bugado of Total Energies. Third, heartbreak again for Matteo Jorgensen. We'll hear from him a little bit later on. Fourth, Tish Benoot, who was kind of in there as a bit of a policeman for Jumbo Visma. Fifth, Tobias Haaland Johannesson of Uno X. And then Thibaut Pinot in sixth. And that moves him 5 places up the GC into the top 10. Guillaume Martin of Cofidis also moves up 5 to 13th place. The other big news today is that Fabio Jakobsen of Sudal Quickstep did not start, still struggling terribly since since that crash on the motor racing circuit. So does that simplify Sudal Quickstep's remainder of the tour, or does it make it even harder for them to win a stage? Who knows? And David de la Cruz of Astana, who was up the road on his own very early on, then crashed out and has withdrawn from the race. It's all the P's in the other jersey. Jasper Philipsen, Nielsen Paulus and Tadej Pogacar in green, polka dots and white respectively. Tomorrow, it's the third summit finish of the tour at Le Grand Colombier. But let's hear a little bit more from Bingham Fernandez of Cofidis about the importance of getting 2 riders into that break and then how they finished it off. Everyone knows this team has waited so long for a tour stage win and now you have 2. What has changed?
I don't know. I think this is the work we are doing the last years. No, we came to the team in the last 3 years. Cedric is improving. Cedric Vasseur is the manager who is improving things, and I think it's the result of all those things. No, I think everything goes in a good direction, and when you win, it always goes in a nice, good direction. So we have to think. It's been a teamwork for everyone, and the path we took, but it looks like it's a good one.
How important is it on a day like today to have more than one rider in a break like that?
It was good because we had Guillaume that could we have Jon attacking and Guillaume behind, so we were thinking that good could be organized, and if they kept attacking, if someone could go, they could just reduce that gap. No, we said to Guillaume, keep the all together, keep all those guys, don't let them go. And then that was the teamwork that he did that helped the victory, which is John's victory, but it's Guillaume's victory and it's the team victory.
What did you think when Van der Poel went up the road? Did you think maybe he could do it? He's a type of rider who could ride from 40 or 50k from the finish.
I think he had to anticipate because looking that he had the riders like Pinot and those guys, they were better climbers. He got to anticipate. I think he did a good move. He was thinking that he could just pass that leader. It was just a hard climb, but the last climb, and it was a good move. But then the riders came from the back. They were strong. He couldn't pass. That for us was good because he was in the front. Arrived with him from the top to the finish. For sure, he was the winner.
The cycling podcast at the 2023 Tour de France is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
This is Science in Sport Chief Executive Stephen Moon talking about why Science in Sport was keen to get involved with supporting the Tour de l'Ansar in Sierra Leone in the first place.
We're one community, and it doesn't matter if we're tying off inner tubes or with Tom Pidcock scorching down Alpe d'Huez, we're all part of the same community. So no financial return, but yeah, I think there's a real authenticity for all of us. And you guys do it very well with the podcast. It's a massive community. You know, you branch off into other areas like long distance cycling, but we're all part of that community. So there's no hard-nosed answer, but there's a moral answer. It's not some kind of worthy thing. It's a recognition of cycling as a global sport and we're a global sisterhood and brotherhood.
Check out the full range of Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com. Impressive by Jon Izagirre, no doubt. And Cofidis looked like a team reborn since Victor Laffey's victory at the start of the tour. I mean, it's easy to say now because they've won, but they didn't look like the kind of slightly hapless Cofidis we often see. You know, it's not unusual for them to get 1, 2, sometimes even 3 riders in breaks like that, but they rarely seem to make those numbers count. Today, they pretty much got it all right, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, they've definitely had a rebirth here. You know, the 15-year drought has come, it's well and done over. And, you know, we were sitting after the stage at their team bus, and it was ironic to see Cofidis park next to Team Ineos, and there was almost no fans, no media at Team Ineos, which is, you know, for the last decade has been the team. No one. And you look over at Cofidis, and there was cameras and fans and people cheering. And you know, hats off to them for, you know, kind of turning things around this tour. You know, they're on a roll now. I wouldn't be surprised if we see them take another stage win, but really impressive and really just kind of apparent of how much a stage victory means here. You know, today I was walking past the Astana bus, no one's outside the bus, but you know, a stage win from here until Paris, Cofidis is going to continually be a team that people are drawn to.
Absolutely. I mean, number one French team in the tour, really, at the moment. When Mathieu van der Poel went away, though, he was doing the sort of thing that only a select few riders could really attempt to pull off. I mean, what do you think tactically he was thinking? Because they were two really hard second category climbs. He's a decent climber, a classics, a genius, really, in the same bracket as Wout van Aert. But those climbs quite hard. What was he actually trying to do there, do you think?
When I first saw it, I was a bit puzzled and thinking, you know, these riders, Van Aert, Van der Poel, they don't want to just win. They want to win with style. But then I started to look at the profile a bit more and realized that there were some really good climbers in that group. You know, having the likes of Pino and Izaguirre and, you know, even Guillaume Martin, he had to get a gap before that final climb. And even though today wouldn't be considered a mountain day, you know, the last climb was 5+ K at 7+%. So that's a hard climb. And, you know, those are the climbs that really catch people out. And, you know, the pure climbers can really open it up and let it go on those climbs. So I think he knew that he had to have a gap in order to make it over that final climb and also get rid of some of the other fastmen. You know, Dylan Teuns, more often than not, you would think Van der Poel would beat him in a sprint, but you never know after a hard day of racing. So, you know, distance some of the other fastmen and hopefully try to get a gap and make it to the top of that final climb, as, you know, the likes of Pino and Guillaume Martin would hopefully catch him before he got there.
Yeah, it didn't quite come off for him, did it? Because, yeah, clearly trying to whittle down the numbers, get rid of the few threats that might have been in a sprint finish. But in the end, he got done by the better climbers on that final climb. Mitch was talking to us at breakfast before he went off to do his incredibly hard bike ride to Sestriere, which I think is tomorrow. But he was saying, and I think he said it a couple of days ago as well, about just how much the profile, the short stage, the amount of climbing, the fact that everybody knows that this is an opportunity for a huge number of riders today. Probably, I don't know how many riders, I'm picking a number out of the air, but probably 60, 70 riders might have looked at today and thought, this is my day to get in the break, and if everything goes well, I could maybe be in with a shout. What's that feeling like? I mean, you rode the tour for Katusha, you've ridden stages like this in the Dauphiné for Team Sky. Do the butterflies get going on days like today, even more so perhaps than on the classic mountain stages, where at least everybody knows the race is going to be a little bit calmer, a little bit more formulaic, I suppose? Today was just complete carnage from the start.
Absolutely. I think these are some of the hardest days of the race. You know, we're also in the smack dab center of, you know, of France, but also of the Tour de France. And, you know, this is the point when Paris still seems like a long way away. And, you know, fatigue is setting in. You know, we've come off a rest day. We've had some hard days of racing since. But there are so many riders that have the possibility of winning a day like today. You know, we saw the likes of Van der Poel, but we also had the GC riders going for it from the gun. When you all of a sudden have 70 riders with the possibility of winning the stage, it really does make the race more challenging because everyone's trying to utilize their strength, whether it's, you know, a short climb early on, a descent, and the stage is on from the beginning. There's no gruppetto that establishes from the start and everyone realizes that, hey, you know, at this first climb, 20K in, there's going to be a gruppetto. We can ride steady to the finish. You know, everyone's trying to make it because who knows when the break is actually going to go.
Well, one man who really fancied his chances today, he said to you yesterday, I think, or maybe the day before, that this was the stage that he had in mind after that heroic, but in the end, unsuccessful ride on Le Puy de Dôme on Sunday. And it's Matteo Jorgensen of Movistar, American rider, of course. Well, he rode extremely well, but didn't quite have it at the finish. Finished third, and he spoke to reporters at the team bus at the end of the stage, and well, you can hear from what he says and how he says it how he was feeling.
I don't know why he wasn't riding through, and then Guillaume Martin was just sitting on, which is expected, but then Pino was kind of just riding for GC. It was frustrating. I mean, really frustrating.
I know you're disappointed, but you said to us this morning there was maybe one more chance for you. It must be satisfying nonetheless to know that there is that pressure on you and to have delivered.
No, it's not satisfying at all. No. I mean, today was the best stage of the tour for me, and I don't know. The stages to come are all for the small guys, so yeah, we'll try to give it a crack, but just pretty gutted. Today I was never in the race for the win. I mean, I was just a marked man. Puy de Dôme, at least I was out there and was way closer to the win than I was today. third versus fourth doesn't matter at all. I mean, even the sprint for second was just kind of whatever. It doesn't matter. The win is what counts, and just I'm going to have to think about this day a bit more.
Sounded like he was being pretty hard on himself there. Given the opportunity to say that he was pleased with himself or pleased with how the day had gone, he pretty much dismissed that suggestion. And I suppose that demonstrates just how much he's kind of risen in stature in his own mind as much as anything since Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, as we said earlier, we were a little bit late to the finish. Couldn't get across the road. So, you know, I had this question in my mind getting ready to speak to Matteo, like, hey, like, you're one step closer. You know, he's finished now three times fourth in the Tour de France on a stage. Today he was third. You know, and he rode really well today. You know, so he's becoming kind of one of these perennial breakaway riders who is hunting stage wins at the Tour de France. And I assumed he was going to be happy with his result. And you could hear from his voice that, you know, he was almost disgusted and frustrated. And for me, as a friend of Matteo, it was really hard to see that because, you know, this is the biggest race in the world. And he has had a great Tour de France. But whether that pressure is coming from himself, from the team, you know, he really feels it. And as he said, you know, he kind of feels like this was maybe his last chance in this year's Tour to get that stage win. And he put himself in the right place. He was there. He was close. But once again, just a little bit off the mark.
Well, if the rumors are true about where he might be going next in his career, the chances to win a Tour de France stage might be running out in a funny kind of way, because he might be buzzing around for another team at next year's Tour de France. As you say, you know, he had pinpointed this stage as one that would suit him, and he said at the end there, it's over to the skinnier guys, the lighter guys for the mountain stages. But you just never know if he, well, yeah, the climbs over the final phase of the race are a completely different proposition to what we saw today. But hats off to him, rode extremely aggressively. Third place, I think, says something about a rider when he can ride like that just a few days after the Puy de Dôme ride and be disappointed with his performance. What about Thibaut Pinot then? Because this is his final Tour de France. He's kind of the darling of French cycling, and well, he's a slightly eccentric rider, isn't he? You know, he sort of wanders back into the GC battle when he's already kind of out of it, but when he's in the GC battle, he seems to wilt under the pressure. And without being flippant about AG2R, I do wonder whether they were chasing hard because Pinot was in that break, perhaps, you know, in that battle for outside top 10 placings. Felix Gall is still in that. Remember, Ben O'Connor was already off the back, so actually putting their own teammate further out of the GC, AG2R. It did look like a bit of a French battle, that. But Pinot, right back in the GC tonight.
Yeah, and I'm a little bit confused by, well, again, AG2R, but even with Pinot, you know, I guess coming into this tour, I thought, what does success look like for him at this Tour de France? You know, a stage win would be huge. And then I thought, okay, well, if he can't do that, maybe he'll go for the KOM jersey. But today he wasn't chasing points. You know, he was at the top of the final climb with Jorgensen, and Jorgensen took the points. You know, he's second. There's still plenty of points for him to take the KOM jersey if he were to hunt that, but it didn't look like that today. But he's also put himself back in a position where he's far back on GC, but he's up there close enough. He's not going to get in a 15-minute breakaway and have an opportunity to win a stage because he's too close at this point in time, because he gained time back today. And this has kind of been a reoccurring theme over the last couple of years for Pinot, where he's not riding GC, but he's also not losing enough time to go for these stage wins.
Just back to Movistar, one point I wanted to ask you about, Ian, was the way that Matteo Jorgensen and Ruben Guerrero worked together, or kind of didn't work together. It didn't look like a sort of tandem effort so much as maybe Cofidis did with Martin and Izaguirre. They didn't look like they were really kind of thinking about how one could do something and then the other could profit off the back of that.
I would completely agree. And, you know, I was teammates with Guerrero on Katusha, and, you know, I know Matteo well, and they're both still very young and hungry riders. And so I wonder if that came into play a little bit, where they both wanted to win the stage. And there's one point on the penultimate climb where Guerrero went off the front, and I was like, oh, well, maybe he's going to go up the front. He's actually feeling good. He's going to bridge across to Vanderpool, and, you know, Matteo has a free ride. But as it turns out, you know, Matteo had better legs in the end, and Guerrero didn't really do a lot to set him up for a stage win. Having not listened to all of Matteo's interview at the finish, I do think part of that frustration was with his teammate and how his team rode. To know that he clearly showed that he had the legs to be there, but that maybe he didn't have the belief of his team, not saying his team, but maybe some of his teammates behind him to win that stage.
Just before we move on from the stage, the suffering is over for Fabio Jakobsen for this Tour de France. Caleb Ewan, though, is struggling on, finished last with only his teammate Jasper de Bust for company, the Lotto Destiny sprinter. Well, we did wonder whether, you know, he was sandbagging a bit the other day with us, with yesterday's sprint stage to come, but clearly all is not well for Ewan, and a difficult few days for all of the sprinters coming up. The Cycling Podcast is very proud to be partnered with MAP, the clothing company from Melbourne, and we've been hearing from Harry Osborne, the head of design, about the design process and how they intend to stretch the boundaries with the design work, not just in terms of the aesthetics, but also the technical function of the clothing.
Performance at MAP's obviously hugely important, but we try to look at our, you know, design process, you know, really holistically. As a team, I suppose our vision is to, yeah, create products that really challenge some of the old codes of cycling. And that's done through really, this continuous pursuit of technical advancement, you know, whether that be through fabrics and manufacturing techniques. Also looking at the other side of things, you know, how we can bring sort of progressive styling, distinct level of creativity to the market in a MAP way. It's really looking at both sides of the coin. It's a performance driven aspect, but also what level of style and creativity outside the function are we bringing to the market.
Go to map.cc and you can get your hands on the Cycling Podcast jersey and other accessories. We'll hear more from Harry a bit later on in the tour. Now it's time to hear from a man who has, well, the best seat in the house, but today doesn't sound like it was a terribly comfortable ride.
This is Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, sitting at the back of the bike.
Bonjour, bonjour, another day in the life of Radio Tour. Another crazy day on the Tour de France. Now, was today different to the others? Well, not really, it's just far more intense. My day starts 3 hours before the start of the stage, when I show up to the start. Only today I had to do far more interviews because it was really hard to pinpoint who the guys would be in the breakaway. Once that was done, my main concern was to find toilets. And I did find a toilet, only the person inside the toilet stayed there for at least 15 minutes, thank you very much. So I was never able to have a pee, sorry. Meaning that I entered the red car, we started the stage, and we knew that it would be flat out from kilometer zero for basically 2 hours. So it was an uncomfortable 2 hours of racing. Eventually, a group pulled away, and we were able to stop for obvious and natural reasons. Other than that, yeah, well, it's really just far more intense. You have to be more focused because so many things can happen. You have to give gaps between the leading rider and the chasing group, between the leading rider and the yellow jersey group, between the leading rider and the group of drop riders. So it was a pretty crazy day, and I know it's not over. Oh, and one final thing. I wasn't able to have my lunch, my sandwich, before 3:30. There was a grumpy Seb in race direction car number 2 today.
We've been asked, what does Seb Piquet do? Obviously, viewers who watch the coverage on TV may well hear him asking the questions at the finish of the stage, but for the rest of the day, he is in the red car, the race direction car at the front. He is trying to keep the entire Tour de France entourage informed about the time gaps and who's in the moves. As a rider, did you ever come across Seb Piquet at all in the ASO races?
I did once at the Tour, actually, on Bastille Day, which is tomorrow. It was an odd Bastille Day. I think it was a relatively flat day, and no one wanted to go in the breakaway. And at the time, I was trying to renew my car séjour, my visa for living in France. And I think I went to Seb Piquet because, you know, his voice is recognizable. You know, he spoke English, and I had pitched the idea to him if I were to go in the breakaway as, you know, maybe the honorary Frenchman for the day, would they exchange my efforts with a French passport? Didn't happen. Still don't have a French passport. But yeah, I mean, his voice is very recognizable. You know, you hear him in all the big ASO races, and we actually got a chat with him a bit in the press room the other day, and yeah, cool as a cucumber.
He's an extremely influential man, said Piquet, but I'm not sure he can sort you out with a passport or citizenship. And but I feel his pain there. Nothing worse than missing lunch on the Tour de France. And I took the opportunity at lunchtime before we left the start to have a Charolais beef burger. And, well, it was just what I needed after last night's Charolais beef. But more of that a bit later on. Last night in the podcast, Ian, we were talking a little bit about this contrast of characters between Jonas Vingegaard and Tadej Pogacar, and how the whole sort of storytelling of the Tour de France hinges on the character of the main protagonist. And there was that kind of downbeat feeling after Vingegaard's press conference, because the media are assembled there to try and get under the skin of the maillot jaune and really peel away the layers. And, well, we kind of get the sense that there's not an awful lot of complexity there. Whether that's an unfair impression, it is nevertheless the impression that we have, especially when contrasted with Pogacar, who is flamboyant. He races with panache, but he's also, you know, he responds to the media with a glint in his eye, and his personality really comes across on his own social media. You spoke to Luke Maguire, who's the press chief for Team UAE Emirates, and well, let's hear what Luke says about how they manage the image of Tadej Pogacar as much as anything.
Last night on our podcast, we were talking about the importance and I guess potentially the training that teams give to athletes, and especially a rider like Pogacar or Vingegaard, who are projected into this role of kind of sharing who they are over a very short course of time during an interview. At UAE, do you guys give any sort of media training to someone like Pogacar, who finds himself regularly being asked questions?
Well, I think in the case of Tadej, we're very lucky that he's been blessed with not only great talent on the bike, but also a very outgoing, easygoing personality that people can relate to and cyclists can relate to. Apart from being a racer, he loves the sport, he loves to have fun, to joke around, and yeah, I guess people enjoy that. As far as training goes, I mean, we give a generic meeting at the start of the year. It is something we do pay attention to, but a lot of it comes from the athletes, from their personality, and if they have the personality, well, we do like to show it.
With Tadej, he's such a unique individual because his personality really does come through. You know, the other day he was riding with a baguette, you know, and he posted that on Instagram, and of course people could see that as, oh, he's messing around, but he's, you know, trying to win the Tour de France. Is that something that the team embraces and wants to share, or is that Tadej kind of by himself going out on a whim and, you know, just joking around?
Maybe a bit of both, but I'd say definitely it starts from Tadej, and we latch onto it. For him, it's a good way of keeping the stress off himself as well. Him having fun on the bike results in, you know, a lot less mental stress, because in the end, after a stage, he does have to spend a lot of time, you know, with the press conference, mixed zone, podium. He's had the podium every day since day one, since he's had the white jersey. So if you add up all the hours, it's a lot of time. And I guess for an athlete, you can either choose to enjoy those hours or not, or make them more difficult for yourself. And he chooses the former.
Ian, you've got your podcast, of course, Breakfast with Boz. You're always very approachable at the start and finish of races. Was media something that you enjoyed, or did you see it as a kind of an opportunity to kind of build your profile, get your face out there, when maybe, I don't want to be unkind, but you weren't a prolific winner. You were a sort of domestique for stages like today, almost.
Yeah, I mean, I never minded doing any sort of media. You know, I felt like it was an opportunity to, you know, share my experience as well. And I guess, you know, looking back on it now, I can go back and listen to, you know, 2018. I did a daily diary with the cycling podcast, and it's almost like my journal from the 2018 tour. You know, and having this conversation last night really got me thinking about how much influence journalists have, you know, and you really have this snippet into a rider, who they are, in this very short amount of time at this press conference. And you know, it's at the end of the day, for them, it doesn't really mean anything. You know, they're thinking about, you know, what happened in the stage, getting home, getting recovered, what's up coming up tomorrow. But this is a very small opportunity that they have to shape the narrative and the character of who they are. Myself as a rider, I never, you know, was in a situation like that where I was given an interview and my words were going to be a reflection of who I am globally. In the press booth, you know, there are journalists from around the world. And so when Vingegaard is speaking to, you know, 15 or 20 journalists there in front of him, that is what's being relayed around the globe. You know, that press conference isn't open to the public. It's open to the journalist, and they're asking questions. He's responding. And when he does give these, you know, short, boring, bland answers, it leaves so much room for journalists to kind of just either make stuff up or kind of share his lack of interest.
Yeah, I'm not sure make stuff up. I mean, I wouldn't say, I think that's a sort of a bit of a sort of stereotypical way of looking at the job of the media, but they certainly would amplify the very little nuggets or kernels of information that they get. Hence, Primoz Roglic, who is similarly sort of, although he's got a bit more of a kind of a dry sense of humour, but he's a similarly sort of taciturn character. It's why the one thing we know about him is that he was a former ski jumper, and I suppose the same could be said about Vingegaard and the previous job working in the fish factory. I would also caveat all of this by saying that Vingegaard and most of the riders are communicating with the media in a second language, generally English, and often the journalists are asking questions in a second language as well, usually English. And so it does kind of insert quite a few barriers into what could be the process of building relationships, making him feel more comfortable in what is a very alien situation. He's in a little cabin at the finish line. He's watching a screen. He can see the faces in the press room. We're watching him on a screen as well. It's an artificial relationship that develops. But yeah, I do think that it would probably do him a few more favours if he just relaxed the shoulders a little bit and let us know who he was. On the other hand, and I'm looking, you know, I'm twisting myself round and round here trying to see all sides of the story. At the end of the day, his job is to work for Jumbo-Visma, and Jumbo-Visma want him to win the Tour de France. I mean, I overheard Marijn Zeeman earlier this week talking to a Scandinavian journalist who was sort of asking, you know, why doesn't Jonas Vingegaard do more press? You know, why isn't he a bit more open? And I think at the end of the day, you just have to allow and accept that people's characters are people's characters, and that is it. But I do think that there's quite an energy in the press pack that they would quite like Pogacar to take the yellow jersey and kind of bring things to life a little bit.
Yeah, and you kind of hit the nail on the head there. It is wild to think that a rider can be thrusted into this position where every day he's being asked questions. And, you know, and the fact that, you know, as Luke said, you know, Pogacar has been in the press conference he's had a jersey every single day since stage one. I mean, how many more questions can you ask? Pogacar handles that really well, and I think he's also been a rider in somewhat of the spotlight since he was young. And Vingegaard by no means came from nowhere, but he, in the last 3 years, he has been thrusted from a rider trying to be the best he can to now being asked questions every single day at the Tour about a variety of topics. And it's not his personality. And, you know, I've realized during this Tour, you know, we've been speaking about riders that, you know, I was teammates with or whatnot, and you have a very different perspective of them than I do, you know, because I know these riders behind the curtain, being at their weddings or birthday parties or hanging out, having a beer with them. And I'm like, he's such a cool guy. But your perspective is what you get from them outside the bus. And that can be very different.
Indeed it can. Yeah, there's some barking in the background there. One of the team press officers, I think, trying to, you know, stop this conversation going any further. We're missing Mitch, of course, already. We got to the finish here a lot slower than we might have done if he'd been driving. I mean, he drives right on the speed limit. I should just clarify that. It's not, you know, he's not reckless. He's very, very safe. Well, he's a very upbeat character, isn't he? Got an opinion about everything, and he's incredibly curious about the Tour de France. And he's almost become a sort of an Aussie François Thomazeau. Speaking of whom...
Now for some French flavour with B, François Thomazeau.
And the flavour of the day, obviously, is that of red wine, because you spent the day, Lionel and Ian, in the Beaujolais region. Actually, would you be able to name the 10 vintages of Beaujolais? You have 20 seconds. Okay, leave 20 seconds here. No, so the 10 vintages of Beaujolais, for you dear listeners who might have forgotten one, are Saint-Amour, Julienas, Chenas, Moulin-à-Vent, Fleury, Chirouble, Morgon, Régnier, Brouilly, and Côte de Brouilly. You also have, of course, the normal Beaujolais wine or Beaujolais Village, and of course the famous Beaujolais Nouveau, well, not so famous, but that's, you know, that's sold as a commercial operation every year. Actually, you went through 6 of the 10 vintages of Beaujolais today in the stage. I must say, I've been through most of those little towns, not to drink wine, but because Paris-Nice stops in the Beaujolais towns very often. The Tour de France didn't stop that many often in the Beaujolais. It goes through it, but there was a couple of stages, one in Reignier-Durette in 2002. It was a time trial. I couldn't name the winner of this time trial in the official tourist guide, so I suppose it's probably an American guy. And then there was another time trial starting the Beaujolais in 2012, starting for Villiers-Morgon and finishing in Bourg-en-Bresse, and it was won by the guy who was going to win the Tour de France, the first Briton to do so, Bradley Wiggins. As we talk of Bradley Wiggins, you started from Roanne, and Roanne in 2019, you had a time trial in the Critérium du Dauphiné. It was good memory for Wout van Aert, who won that time trial that day, but dreadful memories, of course, for Christopher Froome, who crashed before the time trial took place. And as everybody knows, yeah, the crash nearly ruined his career and ruined all his chances to claim a fifth Tour de France victory. That was for Roanne. Roanne, known for to the French public since we were in the French flavor, for the Trois Gros brothers, who were the owners of a famous restaurant there in Roanne and known all over France. If you ask me my favorite of the 10 Beaujolais vintages, I would go for Morgon, and especially a Morgon made by Marcel Lapierre. He's a very famous wine grower in the Beaujolais region, and his Morgon is a classic and it's very good. If you look for good Beaujolais, go for Foyard as well. It's a good, you know, good bet. You can be sure they do good wines. Another place that makes very good Beaujolais wines, and especially Morgon ones, is the Château de Pizay. Guys, I don't know where you're planning to have dinner tonight, but if you have enough money, because it's not cheap, try Château de Pizay. It's a very, very nice place, and the food is excellent. And also, as I said, the Beaujolais wines they make are pretty good. Château de Pizay. Okay, guys, let's talk soon. Bye-bye.
A little wine test there. We didn't have time to insert our answers in there, unfortunately, but I'm pretty confident we would have got 10 out of 10. I certainly knew Chenasse and Beaujolais Nouveau.
I was a 0 out of 10. I feel like I was my knowledge of wine is much more in line with Richard Moore. Red, white, nice, very nice.
And rosé, of course. And rosé, of course, yes. Well, let's look back, 12 hours or so to...
L'étape de demain, le dîner d'hier. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Last night, Ian, we recorded our podcast in Moulins after the finish, and then we drove across country, Mitch drove across country, to get us to Charolles, where we stayed with friends of the podcast, Chris and Tamsin. Now, a couple of years ago now, 2021, Chris and Tamsin invited the Cycling Podcast to stay with them. They used to run a guest house. They no longer run the guest house, but on that occasion, Richard Moore, Francois Tomazo and Kate Wagner had a very pleasant evening with Chris and Tamsin, and I had the real kind of sense of missing out, and I was really grateful to Chris for getting in touch when the tour route was announced to extend that invitation again, and we were delighted to take him up on it. We went to their beautiful home in Charolles, which in itself is a lovely town, and we met fellow friends of the podcast, David and Sam, and had a very pleasant evening indeed. The wine was fantastic. The Charolais beef was exceptional, wasn't it? Being cooked over an open flame, it had a real lovely smoky flavour. Just a lovely evening, a break from the kind of formality of a restaurant meal and a hotel bedroom.
Yeah, it was. And one of the things we'd had kind of for the first time on the tour was vegetables. And not were they only vegetables, and we had some potatoes, some French fries. I guess you call them what? Crisps?
Wedges. I think wedges.
Yeah, right. They were big. Yeah. But they were from their garden. That is one thing you notice traveling and eating in restaurants in France is you really lack the vegetables. So we had those. They were from their garden. And then this morning, we got to do a little walk around the town, and we actually went to their garden plot and got to walk through their garden and see where most of our dinner last night was grown.
We did. And we also poked our noses in at the Bernard Thévenet Museum. Thévenet is from the area. In fact, I think Thévenet's sister lives next door to Chris and Tamsin. I think I've remembered
that. I believe
that's
correctly. What he said, yes.
Well, Thévenet, of course, won the Tour de France in 1975 and 1977, if memory serves me correctly, for the Peugeot team. He was the man who ended Eddie Merckx's kind of dominance of the Tour de France in 75. The museum itself was a curious place. Chris described it as very French. It was very French. It had lots of kind of derelict old bicycles without tyres or, you know, saddles or pedals outside. There was a huge ice cream shop freezer as well.
Empty unfortunately. Empty. But plugged in. It was plugged in. So.
And lots of pictures of not just Thévenet, but also other French star riders. And I gather that the local club meet there. They go back there, get their bikes fixed there, or, you know, have a meet. And there's a Bernard Thévenet Cyclo Sportive, which is held in May as well. So, yeah, and apparently he turns up every now and again, once a year or so, to say hello to all the cyclists. Should also just say, to continue the cycling link, Chris and Tamsin aren't just cycling podcast fans, but Tamsin's son is James Hayden, the endurance rider who won the Transcontinental a couple of times and has featured on the cycling podcast Explore, and I promised I would give a shout out to James. Hello, James, if you're listening, it'd be great to have you back on the podcast towards the end of the year, talking about your latest exploits. Now, that was yesterday's dinner. It was a very late night, wasn't it? I think 1 a.m. So we were outside the time cut, really, last night. And then I woke up extremely early, about 5. So I've operated today on 4 hours sleep. I've not felt the best for it. So I'm hoping that tonight we can have a nice early dinner, keep the Beaujolais nice and light, and an early night, because it's a big stage of the Tour de France tomorrow, isn't it?
It is, yes. We are in the Alps, my favorite region of France, my favorite stages of the Tour de France, and tomorrow is also Bastille Day tomorrow. So to be noted, watch out for French riders heading up the road. Tomorrow is 137.88K. And here I go. Now Mitch has his opportunity to diss my French. We start in Châtillon-sur-Chalaronne, and we finish at the Grand Colombier, which is a climb of 17.4 kilometers at 7.1%. That is the only categorized climb of the day. There is a sprint in the middle of the stage at 87.3K. It is an uphill sprint,
which they put on the top of a great big hill. Look at that.
They did.
I mean, that is a real Giro d'Italia style hoodwinking in the road book, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, it's relatively a flat run-in until the final climb. I mean, there is this bump for the sprint, but 17.4K climb, 7.1%. I mean, I haven't been here the whole tour, but I think the longest climb of this year's Tour de France thus far.
And a small correction corner, because I believe it's in the Jura tomorrow. Not quite in the Alps. We're in the Jura, the Grand Colombier. But there we are.
There we go. Yeah.
There we are. I'm always caught out by that. I mean, these mountain ranges kind of merge into one another. But
are we not in Haute-Savoie?
Francois has explained this before. Listeners, go back and listen to the episode where Francois explains this. But I believe the Grand Colombier is in the Jura. And if that's not correct, then feel free to correct my correction. What do we expect tomorrow? Anticipating Vingegaard against Pogacar, of course, but it's a big opportunity for the rest of the top 10 to either cement those positions, or in the case of Carlos Rodriguez, Pau Bilbao, Simon Yates, even Tom Pidcock, to put a bit of pressure on Jai Hindley in the race for that third place on the podium.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first of a really big weekend to come. You know, 3 days in the Alps, rest day, time trial, then another day in the Alps up to Courchevel. There's going to be a battle on this final climb. I would expect tomorrow that something's going to go, and we're going to see two races. We're going to see a race for the stage win, and we're going to see the GC riders duking it out. This is also a territory where Jonas Vingegaard is expecting to have an advantage on Pogacar, these longer climbs. I haven't checked the weather forecast yet, but it's going to be a battle. And these next 3 days, and we saw them, you know, they're racing full gas today for, you know, on a relatively, you know, kind of transitional day. But if Vingegaard wants to get time on Pogacar, he has to start tomorrow.
Indeed, he does. I mean, you say it could be a race for the break to win the stage. Roughly, what sort of time gap do you think they would need at the bottom of the Grand Colombier to have a chance of staying away? I guess it depends on how aggressive the stage is raced beforehand, but roughly speaking, do they need, what, 8 minutes?
It also depends really on who's in the break. You know, are they a good climber? But given the fact that, you know, essentially the first 74 kilometers are pretty flat, you'd be looking for a climber who has maybe a teammate or two in the breakaway. You know, think about someone who's got a big rouleur who can kind of, you know, sit on the front and drive that break. Because if you have a bunch of climbers up the road, which won't likely be the case, you know, they're going to burn a lot of matches before that final climb. So a breakaway, and ideally, if you are a climber, you would probably want at least 4 minutes at the bottom. Again, it depends on how hard Pogacar and Vingegaard go, because, you know, if even if it's a reasonable climber up the road, they could probably take 4 or 5 minutes out of them, no problem.
But because it's flat at the start, that makes it harder for the climbers to get in the break and stay in the break, I suppose.
It does, yeah. And that's where we could see a group get a lot of time tomorrow. And, you know, something that I mentioned today, again, Jumbo doesn't want Pogačar to take these time bonuses. You know, so if they can let a group go and not control and, you know, let it get time where they know the stage win's going to be gone, you know, coming up, what we have coming, if those two riders come to the finish, Pogačar is going to just chip away at time bonuses. So I do think that Jumbo wants a break to go, just so they can guarantee he's not going to get those time bonuses at the finish line.
Well, Ian, we'll see how that pans out tomorrow. And we will be back again in the evening to discuss stage 13 of the Tour de France. We'll be on in the hunt for somewhere to eat dinner, because, as you say, it's July the 14th tomorrow, Bastille Day. It's also a Friday night. I mean, that is the convergence of the three toughest conditions for finding a restaurant open in France that will take us. So maybe we need to get on the internet and book something tomorrow.
And it's the 13th stage, so maybe it's our unlucky day.
Wow, we shall see tomorrow. But until
upside
then,
upside down.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lionel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.